Jairam, dear listeners, and welcome to yet another segment of Afternoon Satsang, where we will be going into the Bhagavata Vahini as penned by our beloved Bhagwan. We have been doing this for quite a number of weeks now, and we have reached the last few chapters of the Bhagavata Vahini. These are the chapters where Raja Parikshit is going to receive the ultimate gift any being can ever receive, that of enlightenment, that of becoming one with the divine. It's amazing. At the same time, it's funny how we have gone through all the stories that, almost all the stories that Raja Parikshit had gone through and more possibly. And we are even now going to speak about, very soon, about how he got liberated. And we continue to live on the earth, in our earthly existence. It's only our prayer that Bhagwan, maybe we have not yet grown spiritually, we are not yet that pure, as King Parikshit, that we get immersed and lose ourselves and achieve the ultimate in 7 days. But hopefully in 7 months or maybe 7 years or 70 years, may we achieve your lotus feet at the end of our earthly sojourn. It is with that prayer that we do this afternoon satsang, as well as any other satsang, or for that matter any other activity that we do in our life, with that prayer and offering at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, let's, as always, welcome Brother Prem to join us. Sai Ram Prem.
Sai Ram Arvind, and Sai Ram to all our listeners. Going back to this beautiful story of Bhagavatam, there's so much more to learn even as you're going through this. You know, as you're reading the Bhagavata Vahini, when you think that this is being penned by Swami, you can, just like how we felt when we were reading through the Ramakatha Rasamrita, you can make out that there are things which Swami is saying for you and me. You know, those people who are fortunate to have Swami in their lives and have the opportunity to relate to Swami and make Him the center of our spiritual progress or whatever we consider as our journey of life. Because what Swami is saying may not be, I think others may not be able to relate as much. And the beauty of the Bhagavatam is, as Swami said in one of those first few chapters, the Bhagavatam is as much a story of the deity of God as much as it is of the devotee. Because when you see another devotee relating to God in this manner, I think that is when you feel that even I can do this, a feeling of camaraderie, you know, I can also relate to God in this manner. In fact, that is what they say. I was just reading about the history of the bhakti movement, which they say happened around when various numbers are given, maybe 500, 600 BC. We spoke about Jainism and Buddhism. That was a time when a lot of intellectualization of the spirituality was happening. You had Adi Shankara and you had Buddha and you had the Jain philosophy, and all of these philosophies are about understanding the nature of the individual and understanding the nature of creation. And suddenly there was this movement or a critical mass of people who came, who were all devoted to God. You had the Shaivite devotees, the Nayanmars and the Alvars. And then in the north, you had the tradition of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the likes. In Maharashtra, you had those many saints.
Many.
Right. But most of them came a little later. But they were all the same wave which kind of swept through this entire subcontinent. But all of that was based on these devotees. These devotees who came out and, you know, they either sang their love for the Lord or wrote in the form of poetry or in the form of stories they love, or they just lived their madness out, if you could put it that way. And seeing that, this feeling that, you know, God is not just a dry subject that you have to just explore and study about, but there is a entity with whom you can actually relate to and strike a beautiful relationship with. And I think that's what the Bhagavatam is about. And many, many times you've said this. This is not written by any ordinary person. This is not being narrated by any ordinary person. It has been written by Vyasa, who has dedicated his entire life to the expounding of Vedanta. And it is being narrated by Shuka, who was supposed to be born realized. The moment he was born, he walks away towards the forest in search of solitude. And such are the people who are talking about the Bhagavatam and saying that here is redemption.
As you said, Swami writes in the beginning that Bhagavatam is about the Bhakta, Bhagwan and Bhakti. All these three, they form the three vertices or three fulcrum points actually for the entire Bhagavatam. So rightly, it is not just about God, it's about the devotee and about devotion as well. I think the previous fortnight when we did the Bhagavatam, we discussed about the various childhood leelas of Krishna. That is the core of the Bhagavatam. Now what happens is, as per the Bhagavata Vahini, Swami writes that Parikshit is very interested to know about one aspect of Krishna's life which has not yet been revealed. It's also very interesting how intuitively, you know, I feel a person is often guided by the three eyes. One is instinct, one is intellect, one is intuition. And instinct is something at the level of the body, intellect is at the level of the intellect, I mean intelligence, and intuition is at a very high spiritual level. And Parikshit intuitively asks for those kinds of stories which are in resonance with the level he has risen to. It's almost like that. Because as we shall see, the two aspects that Parikshit asks about, one after another, are both related to death and how Krishna redeems people from this death. In the sense, when we pray Mrityorma Amrutam Gamaya, how the Lord is able to confer Amrutatvam or the immortality on every being. And that is precisely what Parikshit is seeking. He has realized that, he comes to realize that this world and its pleasures actually hold no meaning. They are very ephemeral and passing. And if he is seeking permanence, it is only at the lotus feet of the Lord. And therefore, it is very interesting how intuitively he asks questions that answer his level of spiritual evolution. So right now Parikshit says to Sage Shuka that, Master, I would love to listen to the education of Lord Krishna. At the same time he also says, I know that the Lord did not have any need for any kind of education. And yet we know that he went and learnt from Rishi Sandipani, the sage Sandipani. Parikshit is sure that Lord Krishna did everything that he did for the redemption of the devotee. So whether it was protecting the Pandavas, whether it was killing of Kaliya, killing of the various other Rakshasas, and now being a pupil under Sandipani. So he says, I am sure, O Master, that it is not as if Lord Krishna needed education or needed to learn, but like he does in every action, he chose this action also, that is to be a pupil of Sandipani, so that he can redeem Sandipani from this cycle of birth and death, so that Sandipani can be conferred the highest, because possibly through his several lifetimes of penance and good deeds, he had reached that level of fruition where the Lord was to come and bestow on him. So I am sure that that is the actual reason, but I would still like to know how it happened. And as always, you know, Shuka is very, very impressed with Parikshit. He agrees. He says, that is indeed the case. I shall narrate to you the story, but your understanding is perfect. It is not as if Krishna needed Sandipani. It was more the case of Sandipani needing Krishna. And so, however one may need Krishna, as his pupil, as the husband, as the spouse, as a friend, as a master, as a guru, whatever role it is, the Lord is ready to take up that role, because he has come only to spread love and redeem.
Even as we were reading this part where Sukha is saying that Krishna is not in need of any kind of education. We must have mentioned this many times before. In some of the discourses that Swami gives, Swami starts making very, very profound references to very great scholars and authors. And when you listen to that, you feel that, you know, Swami must have made this reference somewhere or read this somewhere, because it's not something that you would quote in regular discourse, in, you know, regular conversation. Apparently, once when Swami gave a discourse, Swami spoke about philosophy and the various philosophers, how philosophy itself molded over the centuries. And then Swami started quoting about Western philosophers, and he spoke about some German philosopher whose idea was this, and then somebody challenged it. And all through, I think it was Professor Gokak was translating it then. This must have been in the early 70s or something like that. And at the end of it, he went back to Swami and he said, Swami, how are you quoting all of these works? And you know, I mean, in literature we read about these people. Or when you do a degree in psychology, we tend to read about these people. How is Swami reading, quoting all of these people? Where did Swami read and when did Swami read? He said, And the reply that Swami gave to him was, "I do not have the bad habit of reading books," Swami said. And then, you know, Swami went on to say that this is not any divine power, but this is nothing but the capacity which is there in every human mind. If you're able to train your mind and control your mind in a certain manner, you can access any amount of knowledge from any part of the world. The reason I am saying this is, you know, I think little later when there is this discussion about Maya, we'll come to maybe in the later part of today's program. I think that is what he is referring to, where the reason why God comes down and comes in the form which comes along with Maya is, and when you look at it and say that, no, I won't agree that this Maya belongs to the Lord and I look beyond, he says that accordingly you actually go beyond your own Maya of your form also, which means the God comes down in the form of complete knowledge to kind of indicate to you that the same knowledge is accessible to you if you go beyond your own delusion. And that's what an avatar does. And when we talk about this particular phase, when he goes as a teacher, I think that's what he and Balarama, you know, portray. Because one difference, I think, from the actual Bhagavatam, or generally how we have heard it, I have not gone back to the Bhagavatam and made a reference, generally how we see it or how we have heard the story is, Krishna and Balarama go to Sandipani's ashram from Mathura after he, you know, after the killing of Kamsa and all of that. But Swami writes that he goes from Vrindavan itself. Even before they go to Mathura, it's Yashoda and Nanda who decide that they should go to a preceptor and learn. And that's how they end up in Sandipani Ashram, which is actually quite far from Mathura. It's on the banks of Ganga. Whereas
at Kashi.
Kashi, where, you know, whereas they are in on the banks of Yamuna, much closer to Delhi.
You know, your that narration of Gokak's experience, you know, it reminded me of something that Professor Nanjundaya told me. Nanjundaya sir told recently. I think he narrated elsewhere also. One day, you know, during Darshan, he happened to, I think this is in the 1970s, he saw that Swami was walking during Darshan and he passed by a devotee, went two devotees ahead. Suddenly he stopped, turned back, came walking back to this devotee, waved his palm, circular motion, and created a, I don't know if a ring or a chain, something, he materialized something for him and gave it to him. Now Nanjundaya sir was thinking immediately this very question, you know, like how Professor Gokak was thinking, Swami, how is it that you know all this? A slight variant of that. That question came in his mind, and in this case, just like Professor Gokak did, he also had the innocence, the open-heartedness, and Swami gave him the permission. So after Darshan, he just said, Swami, can I ask you one thing? Swami said, definitely ask me whatever you want. He said, Swami, tell me, every moment, do you know everything? Or is it that when required, you summon on that knowledge and you will it or you desire it and it comes to you? And this is what he asked. And he said the reason why he asked this was because he felt that Swami passed by the devotee and suddenly when, you know, like the database of this devotee was accessed, Swami got to know that, you know, this devotee is in need of this and therefore stopped there, turned around, came back to him and gave him that. So though he did not narrate this episode to Swami, this was the basis on which he asked this question as to, Swami, are you always like God or like you're in a man state and whenever you wish you draw upon that knowledge that you need? That is when he said, Swami told him, Nanjundaya, he addressed him by a name and told him, don't forget that Swami knows everything about everybody all the time. Yet, for different people's benefit, I have to act in different manner. I have to act like I am knowing. I have to act like I am not knowing. What is amazing is, even knowing is supposed to be an act for Swami, you know. Because there is nothing to show. It is not like I got to know. There is nothing. Even ignorance is an acting. Even knowledge is an acting. So that's what Swami told him. I know everything about everybody. I have to act in order to help and benefit different devotees in different manner. It's very evident that Swami is a person with one act achieves multiple things, and we have seen so many instances of that. So that is what Swami was making clear to Professor Nanjundaya sir, and then he told Nanjundaya sir that it is your effort to be ever vigilant and not allow that Maya to overcome you. Don't for a moment also forget this, that Swami knows everything about everybody all the time, and yet he is doing these things. So Maya is really a very, very powerful thing. And you know, so how Swami explains, I don't know if this is in exactly this context, but it is in this context in the sense that it's about Nanjundaya sir. So Nanjundaya sir once was in Swami's car, not actually in Swami's car, before that what happened was, I think in the 1974 or something, a lot of negative things about Swami had come in the press, and there were a lot of people talking a lot of bad things, mm-hmm. which agitated Nanjundaya sir, and he wrote a letter to Swami. In that he wrote saying that, Swami, you are the master of the universe. You can control everything. I pray to you to stop all these people from doing this nonsense, because what they're doing is absolute nonsense. And he had written, he had poured out his heart, and the next day, the next occasion when he had actually given this letter to Swami, I think he sent this letter. He posted this letter. And the next time when he was at Vrindavan, Swami was going out for a drive to the city. He says suddenly he looked at Nanjundaya sir and told him, Nanjundaya, come here. Come sit in the car. Come with me. And as they were driving just out of Whitefield, Swami asked him, what is this that you wrote in the letter yesterday? You seemed very agitated. He again opened up his heart and said, yes, Swami, what is it? These fools, these fellows, they have senseless, they have no idea. They should never. Swami, you are the divine power. You ensure that they can't do all this. You just will it and they won't be able to do all this nonsense. Swami told him, Nanjundaya, it is not your right to ask for others' freedom to be taken away. Swami told him that I have given you freedom. In your freedom, you have chosen to love me and believe me. The same freedom is given to them also. They choose to hate me and revile me. You have no right to even pray to me to take away their freedom. And Swami went on to say, freedom is given, this freedom is given to all. Based on the choice as to how you use the freedom, you will face consequences. You use your freedom wisely, you will get good consequences. You use your freedom recklessly, you will face such consequences. So that is what Swami told him. I mean, you see how much, though Swami is beyond everything, he still puts on this vesture. He puts on the Maya so that, you know, he shows us the way to live, the way. I mean, he is not bound by all these laws and rules. But yet, he is the one who is most adherent to all rules. In fact, if we look at the Central Trust and other administrative things, that institutions that Swami has set up, all of them, Swami ensures they are 100% legal. The Dina Janadharana Patakam, which Swami started in 2002 for orphan children, he put 1 lakh into each child's bank account so that it will grow by the time the child is big, and that money can be given as a corpus to the child. Because of some other kind of act which is against money laundering and such things, there was a rule that one per individual cannot put into anonymous accounts. You know, unrelated accounts, you can't keep putting money like that. It was illegal. What Swami was doing is divine and noble. And yet when this government law came, Swami said, let us not do anything that is illegal. No need, no problem. And that is why after that first batch of children passed out, I don't think the Dina Janadharana Patakam as such continued. Though inspired by it, many multiple Dina Janadharana Patakams have started in different parts. Because Swami was very insistent that I don't want different people to fund this. I want to put in different accounts, but if I'm not allowed to put in different accounts, let it be. Leave it like that. I mean, that much Swami adhered to the legal things. So we are supposed to get inspired by it, but let us not think that he is legally bound. Let us not think that he is bound by these different things. If we think like that is when we get drowned into Maya. As you rightly said, later in this chapter, there's a discussion on Maya. I think that at that point in time, we can just refer to these points we made here because we have already had that discussion here. So Swami told Nanjundaya sir that, you know, why I'm telling that is, he is following all that. And he said, I will give that freedom. If Swami wishes, he can just ensure that nobody talks nonsense. Nobody does nonsense in his name. Why does Swami beat his chest and tell that I don't like it when people collect money in the name of Sai? Swami, if it really affects you, just will it. they won't be able to open their mouth. People get paralyzed. People may, you know, he can just strike them down. But that is not what it is. I am telling them out of compassion, because when you do Daiva Droha, when you do betrayal of God, you will get bad. You will have to reap bad consequences. So I pour out, but the freedom is still yours. After all that you choose to betray, you go ahead and betray. Accordingly, you will get consequences. That is what Swami told Nanjundaya sir. Interestingly, just to conclude this, at that point in time, Nanjundaya sir said, Swami, then please Swami, ensure that when any such dirty things happen in your name, they don't reach my ears. Swami said, that you can pray. That you can pray, that I will ensure. Pray that whenever people do this, it doesn't. Yes, that I can grant it to you. And he was saying that therefore, whatever people say, nonsense, nothing, I am blessed that I don't receive it in my ears. I am happy in my devotion to Swami. So, yeah, I just thought I will recollect these two incidents in connection to what you said.
Right. I mean, even in this case, you know, when talking about Maya, of course, as we were saying that it's going to come later. But this entire discussion is based on that, because Parikshit, the way he's asking the question itself, he's saying that I know that this is a play of Maya, because he says, I mean, from all the narration that we've heard so far, it's so clear that he is the, you know, the sutradhari, the one who is the director of the play. But he decided to join this drama as a learner, as a student, and that's what he wanted to know. Though we're not fortunate enough to really know as much about what Swami did in his schooling days, apart from the few incidents that we know. But I think this idea of Swami trying to gather knowledge or trying to gather information, but all the while knowing much more than even the person who's giving the information, I think is a very common thing. We've come across that so many times. In fact, one of our seniors was telling that the first time that he went up to Swami, those days they used to take lunch for Swami from the hostel. Like how we have the roast duty and the roast chance and the aarti chance. They used to have this lunch chance. They used to take lunch from the hostel and go to Swami's dining hall, and they used to be there till Swami finishes the lunch. And invariably that will be the first interaction a student would have with Swami. So this person went up for that chance, and he happened to be a student who speaks only English and Tamil, right? And the moment Swami got to know that he doesn't know Telugu, Swami started conversing with him only in Telugu, just for the fun of it. He was trying to pull his leg and was trying to ask questions. And this boy also was trying to be smart and answering the questions in English, understanding what Swami may be referring to. So then Swami asks him, I mean, all general questions, where do you come from and what's your father doing and all of that. And he keeps answering all of these questions. Then Swami asks him, how many men and how many women in your house? Okay. Enni adavalu, enni mogavalu. Swami asks in Telugu. Okay. So he says 3 and 2 or something like that. What he was telling was the same thing when you look at it from Tamil. Adavar, I don't know exactly how it is. He says that it gets mixed. The word used for men in Telugu sounds similar to the word used for women in Tamil. And the word used for women in Telugu sounds similar to the word used for men in Tamil. So he answers accordingly, thinking the reverse of that. Okay, and the moment he says that, Swami says, hey, tell properly. Why are you telling wrong? So then he got it that, you know, he must have got the thing wrong. And so he corrected it and he said, and then the conversation went on. And then after that, when he came out, then he said, how did Swami know that it was wrong? Right? It was nothing like, I mean, Swami was just asking about his family and inquiring. How did Swami know that what the answer I was giving is wrong? Right? It could have well been correct. 3 and 2 or 2 and 3 doesn't make much of a difference. But you're saying that it was so nuanced, that that revelation of Swami's omniscience, that it didn't strike him when he was there answering that question. So even when Swami used to come and ask us, where do you come from, what are you doing, and what is your father, and all of that, you know, Swami always knew, as Swami told Nanjundaya sir, but very, very few times he just parted that veil and, you know, showed that he knew.
Because, you know, I feel whenever, even when we converse, when we talk, when we narrate, when we relate all these incidents also, it is so difficult to keep in mind that Swami always knows. You know, when I'm narrating an incident, I will start by telling, and till that point, now the moment Swami got to know this, he became upset. Or, I mean, what do you mean the moment Swami got to know? It so happens, you know, once actually I tried this out, you know, if I can narrate an incident of Bhagwan, keeping all the while in mind that he is divine. you tried Prem Yoga, just can't narrate it, you know. There's no story only there. I mean, you can't tell like when Swami got to know. What do you mean when Swami got to know? Swami knows. So, I realized that even to narrate the Bhagavatam, you need some amount of Maya. Otherwise, you just can't narrate. What do you mean? Because it's all knowledge, it's everything is done. You just can't express in language. Everything becomes so difficult. If narration itself is so tough, I'm just thinking without Maya, world can't go on. No wonder Swami, it is not like Swami created Maya because he likes to befuddle us or cloud us and put us into ignorance. Not like that. If this play of the world has to go on, we need Maya. Just like if I need to enjoy a movie, I need to just have a make-believe world. There are people dying there. There are people, everything is happening. I know the truth that nobody is dying. But at the same time, I need that kind of a illusion so that I can enjoy a movie. At the end of the movie, right, nobody dies. Nothing happens to anybody. Everybody is fine. I know all that. But I enjoy the movie. In the same way, this is the divine movie, the whole world that has been created. And Maya is necessary if you want to enjoy the movie. But at the same time, like in a real movie, while I'm enjoying it, all that while I know that there's nobody bad, there's nobody good, all are actors, I think that we have to keep in mind here also. Here we get so lost in the entertainment that we forget the reality. And that is why those brief moments when Swami reveals. But otherwise it's fine. Even Swami put on the... So Maya is definitely not a very terrible thing. But we make it terrible because we think that is the only reality. We have to keep in mind that it is Maya, it is there for entertainment, it is there for the world to go on, the physical world to go on and the mental world to go on. At a spiritual level, we have to be aware. If that awareness is lost, it becomes a problem. And that is why it's commendable here. See, Parikshit is aware. He knows the truth and yet he wishes to know because it's like entertainment. Possibly a very noble and uplifting form of entertainment to hear the stories of the Lord. So, where the Lord does different things, the Lord learns. You know that the Lord need not learn, but it's enjoyable to listen to how that happened. When all the while in the back of your mind, in the bottom of your heart, you know for sure that this is the truth, yet it's enjoyable. So, knowing the truth, we can definitely indulge in this Maya and enjoy the Maya.
I mean, just like I happened to be talking to one of our lecturers in the university yesterday, and he was saying this, you know, even when you're doing some sadhana, if you're doing some meditation or something, somewhere there is a certain amount of self-benefit, you know, you're looking at when you're doing that. Probably when you're listening to some of these stories, like how Parikshit is listening, I mean, there's nothing to learn. When you look at Swami's life, we always say that Swami's life is Swami's message. So there's something to learn. If you see what Swami did when he was a small child, there's something to learn. But Parikshit is probably a couple of days away from, you know, taking his last breath. There's nothing to learn. There's just the joy of listening and just the joy of living in that moment. There's nothing to learn. There is nothing to gain out of it in that sense. Nothing to look forward to after that. Just the joy of listening to the stories of Krishna. And that is the beauty of listening to any stories of Swami, that beyond the idea of even learning something, just that moment, that bliss that you feel when you listen to Swami's stories.
Absolutely. And this bliss will continue, dear listeners, after a little break. We'll take a little break at this point, after which we will go into how exactly Balarama and Krishna reached Sandipani Ashram and what happened there. Some interesting episodes happened there. All that after this break.
Parabrahma Sai Guru Vandana Satya Sai Sakshat Parabrahma Sai Vandana Satya Sai
Guru Vandana Satya Sai
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were talking about the incident. Parikshit is asking Sukama Rishi to narrate of Krishna spending the time in Sandipani Ashram as a student. And the way he is asking, of course, is very interesting. He says, you know, we all know that Krishna is the director of the play and he plays many roles in the course of his, you know, drama when he enters. And he asks him that when he took up this role of being a student, what all did he do? And we know that there was nothing for him to learn, but he still became a student. What happened? And then Sukamarshi goes on to say that not only did he not need to learn anything, he decided to show it to the world that he actually did not have any need to learn it, because with the dexterity with which he gathered all the knowledge. And then Sukamarshi, of course, gives a comparison of what it is to actually be a person who is very skillful in gathering knowledge, and how Krishna and Balarama actually beat that black and blue, if you could say that record.
Exactly. You know, in fact, he says that they learned the 64 forms of knowledge in 64 days.
Right.
People take years to do that. It's almost like one form of knowledge per day. And if right. you actually look at the 64 forms, it includes things like horse riding, archery, everything, you know.
Music, dance.
It is academics as well as extracurricular, what we have in the modern day education.
And he says, usually, if you can, become an expert in one of these arts in 1 year, then you're a person of very, very fast learning. And as you said, 64.
They become masters of 64.
Right.
So it's almost like 64 years worth of ingenious learning it is.
Right.
But as you briefly hinted, some more detail Swami gives about how Balarama and Krishna, they grew up into very extremely capable and talented youngsters. And that is when at Vrindavan in Gokula, the family priest Garga is called to perform their Upanayanam. Upanayanam is considered as a second birth, because the first birth is when we take a human form, and the Upanayanam is the time when you're initiated into the Gayatri Mantra, and you're initiated into the secret that this life is meant for seeking Brahman. And if you seriously take up that, you become a Brahmin. That's how it is. A Brahmin is a person who pursues Brahman. So this initiation or Upanayana is actually considered as a second birth. And that's why a Brahmin, that is one who is in pursuit of Brahman, is called a Dvija. Dvija means born twice.
Twice born.
And so this Upanayanam is done for Krishna and Balarama. It's amazing, right? Krishna is God incarnate, and he's being taught that the goal of life is to seek God. That's why these avatars, you know, they come to demonstrate to humanity how one should lead one's life. So after this Upanayana ceremony, this is when they begin formal education. After this initiation, imagine like how when we do Akshara Abhyasa, the first thing you are taught to write is the Omkara. That is how it is in the Bharatiya tradition. After that, go ahead and learn other alphabets, other sounds, everything. This is the primordial sound. This is the basis of everything else. This is the Akasha. This is the Shabda Brahma. That is how it is taught. And now you learn everything else. In the same way, when you start picking up knowledge, you start learning about different things, the first thing you're taught is the purpose of life, the goal of life is this. Now go ahead and pick up anything. It doesn't matter if you become a dancer, a charioteer, a king, a potter, whatever you become, it doesn't matter. Don't forget this is the goal. That is taught first, which is so amazing. You know, we had this discussion about children, upbringing, education, the goal of education and all that sometime back in one of our satsangs. I think this is very amazing, something important to remember, that as early as possible, let us teach the child the goal of life is to reach God. And everything else is just the means towards that end. If it's taking you away from that end, then that is of no use. That is something that we have to keep in mind. So, after this Upanayana ceremony, they have to, Swami writes how there was a lot of merriment and festivity in the whole village. A lot of charity was done. Gold was given away in joy. And there were folk arts that were encouraged and all that happened. After which, it is this family priest Garga who says that the best possible teacher for Krishna is Sandipani. And Sandipani is a Brahmin from Avanti, and he is settled now in Kashi, and that is why, as you said, they are taken there. You know, Krishna and Balarama are taken there by the mother and father. They are eager, they want to go and see how the facilities in that Gurukul are. Is it a cool Gurukul or is it a not so cool Gurukul? So they go there, and it reminds one of how our own parents, when first time we had to join the hostel, even though they knew that it is Swami's hostel, it is the best, they would still like to come and see, meet with the teachers, have a look at the hostel. After all, there is that vatsalyam, that love that a parent has for the child and a child for the parent. So it is that vatsalyam that makes Yashoda also accompany, go all the way and drop off Krishna and Balarama at the hermitage of Sandipani. You know, this just reminded me of how even Swami was initiated. We had spoken during the Satyam Shivam Sundaram satsang about how there was this certain Shri P.T. Krishnamachari who initiated Swami into writing. Akshara Abhyasa he did for Swami by holding his finger and making him write Om on the sand, because Swami was from a background that couldn't even possibly afford a slate and a chalk. So on the sand, Swami got his initiation done into the Omkara, into that. So it just was nostalgic to remember that as I read about how Krishna and Balarama were taken and dropped off at Sandipani's ashram. And as you have said after that, they were amazing students. They did everything. And most importantly, I think Swami writes in great detail about the humility, love and reverence that Krishna and Balarama exhibited towards the teacher.
The interesting thing is, you know, the stark contrast between what Krishna was in Gokul Vrindavan and then what he is in the Gurukul. If you look at it, because Swami is saying that in the tutelage of Sandipani, they exhibited idealism as students. There was no more that mischief. There was no more that the stealing of butter and all of those play which we spoke about when they were children in Gokul. At this point, they're like ideal students. And this is, as you said, so beautifully similar to what Swami's childhood was. And we always see that Swami speaks of him as somebody whom all the teachers were fond of. Swami was somebody who was like perfect at everything that he did. And even when he was not doing something, they knew that, you know, he must be doing something better. Mm-hmm. Some of the teachers who knew that, you know, Swami was always a step ahead. And Swami could not be caught with not doing the right thing or doing something which is not acceptable. The same way, Sukha Maharishi is talking about how Krishna was in the Gurukul, where he was perfect all the time, ready to accept any kind of command from the master, exhibiting that kind of humility which a student must exhibit. So that's where Sukha Maharishi says that not only was he playing the drama, but he was playing it in a manner that others can look and learn from it. And this is what you have to do. And if God can exhibit humility, I mean, there's no question of others who learn something, you know, all the knowledge that we have is what we learn, what we've got from outside. And where is the question of us not being humble? And, you know, Sukha Maharishi says that that's the lesson that they taught, that even through the process of education, Krishna was actually teaching others how you should be as a student.
It reminds one of what Swami would say, God knows everything, but behaves as though he knows nothing. Man knows nothing but behaves like as if he knows everything. That is why you see God being so humble, but man being so proud. And Krishna was an epitome of humility. In fact, in the Bhagavata Vaini, Swami writes that every teacher will have students. But to have a student like how Krishna was, even if one in a thousand is like that, it is a great privilege, great benefit, because everything that came out of the guru's mouth or from the guru's being was readily and completely absorbed by these two students, Krishna and Balarama. And in fact, Swami says that it was this kind of focus and attention of these two pupils that encouraged Sandipani to go ahead and teach them very advanced things, what he didn't teach possibly rest of the class because they were still in the lesser subjects. In fact, Swami says that he taught them the four Vedas, the Vedandas, the science of logic, grammar, jurisprudence, economics. He taught them everything that he knew. And as we read that, we understand that when there is humility while learning, the teacher also becomes more readily, they will squeeze themselves completely so that all the knowledge can be conferred. It is when a pupil is humble and so devoted that a teacher feels pride in making the student greater, more better, or more glorious than what he or she is. That is why, you know, you see Drona being so amazed when his student Arjuna surpasses him. So that kind of response from the teacher is elicited by the sincerity and humility of the student. And that was more than amply demonstrated by Krishna and Balarama.
The one point which Swami had made, I think, in Ramkatha Raswaini, when he was talking about Vasishta, you know, where in the Ramayana, Vasishta is the guru of Rama. And Swami says that, you know, sages like Vasishta are actually very, very advanced and very, in very advanced stage of their spirituality, that they could have actually dropped their body long ago. But knowing that, you know, there is going to be this opportunity of interacting with the avatar, Swami says that they use all of their, you know, spiritual wealth to kind of have this opportunity of interacting with the avatar. And the same thing they say about Sandipani, that, you know, all the virtues that he has earned over many lifetimes gives him this opportunity. And similarly, Swami would speak about, you know, whenever Swami is speaking about his teachers, be it Kondappa or, you know, that that Muslim teacher whom Swami speaks about. I think three or four of those, Tirumalachar and Kondappa and all of these teachers who are Swami's principal or teachers, Swami would say that they were not ordinary souls. They were
Mehboob Khan.
They were all souls that were done so much good that they got this opportunity. I think it's quite understandable. If you just look around the ashram, the kind of people who come and settle down as Sevadal or as, you know, taking an opportunity to work in the ashram, be it our own Venkatraman sir or so many people who have been in very exalted positions, S.V. Giri sir, he was the vigilance commissioner. And all of these people, you know, even in a conscious state, when you have an opportunity to serve Swami, no role becomes small enough. I mean, is too small to occupy. You would see that with Sevadal. In fact, I recall that incident when Swami had gone to the Rajmata's house to attend the wedding of the grandson of Rajmata. Right? They had carpeted the entire place, including the garden, as much as possible, wherever they thought Swami would walk.
At Brindavan, right?
At Brindavan, right. But even then, Swami managed to walk on the gravel and on the, you know, the uncarpeted places. That's how Swami would do. Invariably, he would just walk around because he would see some workers or he would see some the cooks whom Swami would want to go and speak to. So like that, Swami started walking on the gravel. And Rajmata's son immediately ran inside the bungalow and he brought a pair of slippers and he put it in front of Swami. The moment Swami saw that, Swami was so thrilled. Swami looked at the students there and Swami said, "He's a king." Swami said, "He's bringing slippers for Swami." See, when you're in that position, you will not think, "Oh, I am a king. I cannot play this role." That's an opportunity for you. So if you can do that job of carrying Swami's sandals and get that opportunity of doing that for Swami, you jump into that scene. I think that is the case with all of these people. They must have been so exalted, probably in the cusp of liberation. But when they saw that there is an opportunity, you know, this vacancy is there, the teacher of Krishna in this particular avatar, are you ready to fill that? And you would say that, any vacancy is ready, you know. And Swami would say that's the same thing with all the Gopalas and Gopis, and the Gopas and Gopis. Because they were all great souls, but when this opportunity to be around them was available, probably they sacrificed even liberation to come and occupy those positions and to enjoy that proximity of Krishna.
Speaking of liberation, there's one interesting episode that Swami narrates, which becomes all the more special because of the stage of life that King Parikshit is in. And this comes towards the end of their education. As we discussed, their education lasted just 3 months, because in the 64 days, or not even 3 months, just 2 months, in 2 months as per the modern calendar, because within 64 days they had mastered all the 64 forms of knowledge. And that's all it is. Swami writes that they stayed there only for a very short period. One thing Krishna and Balarama both would observe is every time that Sandipani is teaching them something, he would be shedding tears. He would be having some kind of a secret grief. And once they had mastered everything, they approach the Guru and tell him this, that, "Guruji, don't mind, but we have observed that you are very sad, you keep crying. What is it that affects you? What is it that afflicts you? We would love to help you with that." And though he is hesitant in the beginning, the two of them coax and cajole the Guru. They tell that, you know, your ananda, your joy is of paramount importance to us. So whatever it is necessary to do to bring joy back to you, we would love to do it. What is it that's bothering you? Please let us know. That is when actually Sandipani narrates. He says, you know, he says it with a kind of despair and a kind of no hope. He tells that, "I will share with you. It's not that I don't want to share, but it's a hopeless situation, because after many years, we managed to get a son. This son was the apple of our eye. He grew up into a lovely lad, everything. But when he had gone on a pilgrimage to Prabhasa Kshetra, we had discussed this also in another satsang. Prabhasa Kshetra is currently the area near the temple Somnath in the Indian state of Gujarat today. That is where also
the Yadavas,
yes, they decimated themselves with that fight in the end. So at Prabhasa Kshetra, when this son of mine, he had gone there and he was in the ocean, he says the ocean swallowed him up, and that's it. I've never seen my son since then. And in these few days, I've been able to experience some joy of a father because of you two. But now you two are also leaving. Your education is done. It again brings back those pangs of my lost son. I have no more hopes of ever seeing him. I think he's dead. He's gone. So this is what rankles me and makes me feel so sad. That's the reason for my tears also. And this is when Sandipani tells this, Krishna says, "Guruji, you want your son, right? As our Guru Dakshina." Because, you know, out of gratitude to what the Guru has done, in the olden times, the students would offer whatever they could, you know. This is so amazing, because there was nothing like fees. Recently, I got a WhatsApp message of one of some premier schools in India. I don't know whether it's Bishop Cotton or Baldwin's or some school like that, with the entire fees for the first year or kindergarten. And it came to an exorbitant amount per year, something like 80,000 or 90,000, and that too for kindergarten. It was shocking, and they put different things, this fees, that fees, this fees, that fees. So shocking. I mean, as Swami said, it has become a commodity, and an expensive commodity at that. That's all it is. No wonder degrees are being used as begging bowls. But in those glorious days, the teachers would do it to impart knowledge to the children, and as gratitude, the society ensured that the teachers would not be in want of anything. They would take care of the needs of the teachers, and the teachers were Brahmins. Brahmins meaning those in quest of Brahman, and therefore their needs also was not large. It's not like they would demand for 2-3 golden chariots or a palace. They had minimal needs, and those minimal needs were more than fulfilled by everyone in society. And towards the end, as their token of gratitude, you know, in modern day context, I can only think of what we as students would love to give Swami. You know, because as our offering of gratitude we would want to give, it was not about the amount of money that went there. It's about the love and gratitude we felt in the heart. And it was so difficult because Swami himself would say, I don't want anything. Your love, that feeling that you have is enough for me. So that was how it was in the glorious days. And so Krishna says that as Guru Dakshina, we will try to locate and get back your son to you. And hearing this, Sandipani is feeling joy at the love of these pupils. And he feels, this love I have won, that's enough for me. And that is when Krishna and Balarama actually set out towards Prabhasa Kshetra.
And talking about giving Guru Dakshina, of course, giving it to Swami is impossible. But it was almost close to impossible to give Guru Dakshina even to any of our teachers for that matter. Because they all knew that they are answerable to Swami. And you know, and that was the culture, of course, which was passed on from Swami to all these people. And you know, talking about just a little bit of this Guru Dakshina concept, we all know that episode which happens with Dronacharya. The Guru Dakshina, Dronacharya asks his disciple Arjuna should imprison Draupadi's father,
King Drupada.
That is the Guru Dakshina he asks. And later Krishna tells him how that was one of the mistakes that Dronacharya does. He says, because even the Guru Dakshina the Guru asks, or even if it is very, very selfish in nature, then the knowledge imparted becomes selfish. So he says that because you wanted that humiliation should be meted out to King Drupada because of the vengeance that he had on him, the knowledge that he transferred also became selfish. So he does not have that authority to call himself an acharya or call himself a guru. That's what apparently Krishna tells him. You're only an acharya. You only imparted knowledge as a teacher. Only one who has given gurus given knowledge selflessly becomes a guru. So even in the idea of asking Guru Dakshina in a voluntary basis, you cannot ask something which is more selfish. That is the level in which a teacher was supposed to live in those days. And even this, as beautifully Swami writes, Sandipani does not ask for this as Guru Dakshina. So Krishna says that we are supposed to give you something, so make this our offering. Permit us to make this our offering. And he says that we will get back your son. And get back a son who has been swallowed by the ocean. It's almost like saying that I'll get back the sun from the dead.
And that is what Krishna discovers too, as we shall learn after this quick little break. Don't go anywhere, because an interesting story is coming up about how actually Krishna brings back the sun from the dead, and why this story becomes so relevant for Parikshit, who is now awaiting his final moment.
Saira, Prem Bharo Dil Mein Hamare Sai Ram, bade pyare Sai Ram.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are in that part of the story where Krishna and Balarama have promised Sage Sandipani, their teacher, that they will bring back the son that they've lost. And I think this is many, many years after the son has been lost also. So they go to this Prabhasa Kshetra, which is supposed to be very famous. We've come across this place being mentioned many, many times in the Bhagavatam itself. So they go to this particular place and they stand in front of the ocean, as the story goes. And Krishna demands that the ocean give back the sun that has been swallowed. And I think at that point the deity of the ocean comes in front of Krishna, falls at his feet, and he says that, you know, I have not done anything wrong. It is not my mistake. It has been the sun has been swallowed by a ogre who lives in the depths of the ocean. And that's how the baton is passed on to this ogre.
It must have been deja vu for the ocean, right? The previous avatar also, Rama had pulled out a bow and threatened to dry it up, and he comes and says, "Oh, Rama, Rama, not my fault. I just did my duty." Now in the next avatar, as Krishna, he comes and again challenges the ocean. And so, yeah, for the lord of the ocean, definitely it was deja vu. But he was offering himself once again, rededicating himself at the lotus feet of the same lord. Same Lord in the sense of, even if you take Rama and Krishna as avatars of Lord Vishnu, it is the same Vishnu there. And therefore he falls at the feet of his Lord Vishnu, and he tells what you said, that I have not swallowed the sun. It is actually a demon by the name Panchajana. Panchajana, who lives in the depths of the ocean, and he has actually swallowed. So in modern context, you can think of him as like some large sea creature, you know, who has swallowed this sun. You know, speaking of Vishnu, again, forgive me for these frequent references to Nanjundaya sir. I have recently spent some time with him and heard from him, and therefore all these. So very interestingly, you know, Swami was narrating once, it seems, that there is one doctor, I forget her name. So Swami said that this doctor, she keeps telling Hari, Hari, Hari. And there is this Mrs. Ratanlal. Mm-hmm. She keeps telling Vishnu, Vishnu, Vishnu. Interestingly, this, I think her name is Rajeshwaramma or something like that. Dr. Rajeshwaramma. So Swami says, Dr. Rajeshwaramma keeps telling Hari, 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 and Mrs. Ratanlal keeps telling Vishnu, Vishnu, Vishnu. Interestingly, Hari was a junior doctor who had just joined in the hospital. And for everything, she would call this Hari and tell her, Hari, do this, Hari, do that. And that is what Swami was referring to. And there was a cook by the name of Vishnu who would help Ratanlal Amma in all her chores and help, you know, in cooking for Swami and all that. So that was the double meaning, you know. But then Swami told it him that, how, but I am the actual Hari, I am the Vishnu, who is calling out to me? This is what Swami told it him. And interestingly, after that he went for darshan. Completing the darshan, he came back and resumed the same conversation. He said, who is Vishnu? And then, what does he hold in his hand? So it was said that Vishnu holds the Shankha, Chakra, Gada and Padma. Mm-hmm. And Swami asked, what is the significance of all this? So somebody said Shankha, somebody volunteered and explained, saying that Swami, Shankha is what creates the primordial sound, the Om. It signifies creation. It means that Vishnu has the creation in his hand. And Chakra is the wheel of time. And it signifies that Krishna has time in his hands. He is the controller of time. He is the master of time. Gada stands for supremacy and power. All the power in the universe rests with Vishnu. And Padma stands for beauty. All the beauty is with Vishnu. And Swami said, you got the first three right. The fourth one is wrong, Swami said. Swami said, Padma stands for the lotus that blossoms within every heart. You know, that is your mind, your innermost core, your heart. That is the Hridaya Pushpa, that thousand-petal lotus that they say that rests within each one of us. Mm-hmm. And Swami said that the Padma in Vishnu's hand signifies that he is the director of your thoughts, instincts, feelings, intuition, everything. Mm-hmm. Everything arises because of Vishnu, because of the Lord. At that time, one of the students who was seated there, he said, Swami, why if you are the one who controls all our thoughts, everything, then why is it that you don't ensure that we get only good thoughts always? Swami said, I want to do it and I'm ready to do that. But for that, the Padma should be offered to Vishnu. He said, for that, you have to offer, surrender your mind to me. You do that, then I will take charge of every thought, feeling, instinct, intuition, everything that arises within you, I will take charge of it. But your duty to surrender and offer that to me. That was what was the discussion, and I just was reminded of this when we were speaking about Vishnu and how the Lord is so supreme. He because when you read about how Krishna commanded the ocean, you wonder how did that happen? When he is able to influence every thought in every being there on the in the universe, what is the big deal in summoning the ocean? And when the ocean passes on the baton to Panchajana, Krishna dives into the ocean, goes into the sea at Prabhasa, locates this Panchajana, who says that he has already swallowed the child and possibly the child rests inside him. So Krishna actually redeems this demon also there, because he tears apart his belly. That is when he notices that the child has already been digested, which means that the son has been transported to the world of death, which is the Yamaloka. And that is when Krishna decides that having come to the bottom of the ocean is not enough, I'm now going to go to the abode of death and get back the son.
And even as he kills this Asura Panchajana, In his intestines, Krishna finds a conch. I mean, of course, it is in the seas. So he picks up this conch, and I mean, it's a huge conch, because it is found in the intestines of Panchajanya. This is the conch which later gets the name Panchajanya. And Panchajanya is the name of Krishna's conch, which he eventually uses thereafter. In fact, in the battlefield of Kurukshetra also, Krishna uses this particular conch. In fact, every warrior has a conch, and that conch has a special name. Like the conch which Arjuna used was, I think, called Devadatta.
Correct.
Huh? Right. So these were, and this is the conch which Krishna blows to start the war during the Kurukshetra, and Bhishma and Drona and all of them have their own specific conches.
And like we have our own caller tunes, you know, like each conch had a particular pitch, frequency and a way of blowing. By listening to the conch, one would know who is coming. That
right,
was
exactly.
How it was.
That was the thing. And I think they also used it to call each other for battle. Like during the battlefield itself, if Arjuna was to take up his conch and blow out, that was to call out that particular warrior in front of him for a one-to-one battle. So that's how Krishna does. He picks up this conch and he goes to the gates of the Lord of Death, and then he blows this conch to catch the attention of Lord Yama. And that's when Lord Yama listens to this, you know, resounding sound of a conch, and he says that, you know, there is somebody who's very, very glorious at the doorstep. And he himself comes running and he finds Krishna at the doorstep. And then Krishna tells him that, you know, I'm looking for I'm looking for the son of my preceptor. I've come to take him back. And when Yama hears this, he does not hesitate one moment. He immediately sends word for his minions and he says, get the boy wherever he is and offer him to Krishna. And that is how the son of Sandipani is brought from the land of the dead and is offered to Krishna.
It reminds us of, you know, these are all descriptions in detail of Krishna going to the doorstep of Yama, but it actually means that the Lord is the master of life, the Lord is the master of death. And it reminds us of so many instances where Swami did. I think we had an entire satsang on this, right? Prem, on all the resurrections right. That Bhagwan had affected. How many people Swami has brought back from the dead, from Walter Coven to Subbamma to Radha Kupam, Radha Krishna, all of those resurrections. So that is what Krishna does here, and it's amazing because for Parikshit, who is listening to the story, it is an assurance that this is the Lord of life. This is the Lord who is with us in life, who is with us even in death. This is one connection that if we get, nothing can sever that connection. All the wealth that we earn in the world, all the respect, the fame, the name, the friendships, the relationships that we acquire in the world, all of that possibly lasts until death. And after death, it's gone. The name will live on. The name will live on, but everything else is gone. But this is a connection that remains. This is a relationship that remains even after death. I'm reminded of a Chinnakatha. When I was searching for stories of Sudama and Krishna. By the way, that is one thing that we forgot. One little story to narrate of what happens in Sandipani's ashram between Sudama and Krishna. If the time doesn't permit us this week, we will take it up next week. But while searching for that, you know, came across another Chinnakatha that Swami narrated in that discourse, where he speaks about true friendship and true relationship.
Mm-hmm.
He says that a man gets a summons to come to court for some case, and he rushes to one of his friends and tells, I have been summoned to the court. And the friend says, oh my God, you know, this court is a scary place. Wish you all the best. Go and come. And he's like, won't you come with me? He says, no, I don't want to come. I'm very scared. I wish you all the best. I'll pray for you. You go on. So he goes to his second friend and he tells, you come with me. You know, this is what has happened. His friend is also very concerned and he says, okay, I'll come. He comes with him. He's ready to come with him, but then he says that I'm not going to come into the court. I will come. I will drop you till the court. You know, it's like I will accompany you in the auto rickshaw or car till there. But Swami says he had a third friend who says that, yes, I'll come to the court. And if necessary, I will stand there and give my testimony. I will stand in front of the judge and I will speak on your behalf because I know you. And Swami says, who do you think is the true friend there? Swami says, so too, man also has three friends like that in life. All the wealth, all the power, all the influence that he has earned is like the first friend. The moment you are dead, that's it. Their connection with you stops. They will not even accompany you till the burial ground. But then he says, but then you have some close family relatives and good friends who will come with you till the burial ground. They are like the second friend who comes up till the court. But then Swami says, it is only your good deeds, your good karma, your sat karma, not just good, only your deeds, that is what will accompany you like a true friend across lifetimes, across births. And while reading that story, I just felt Swami has narrated this Chinnakatha to highlight the importance of our good thoughts, words and deeds. But I feel God is like that friend who will come across lifetimes, because as Swami would himself say, the connection between you and me is not just of this birth. It is spanning so many births. And how loving of Swami to catch us and pull us from different places on earth, different mentalities that we are in, different attitudes we are in, different spiritual planes we are in. He has handpicked and chosen and brought us. That is the kind of connection we share. And it just inspires Parikshit no end, because he realizes that this is the connection that I need to strengthen. And that is why I said in the beginning that it's very interesting how intuitively Parikshit asks questions that leads to stories which will help him in his own spiritual evolution.
Right. Then, you know, even as you were referring to that story which Swami was saying, I think this morning the discourse which was played in that, Swami was telling this very beautiful story. We've heard this statement that Swami would make. Swami would say that all of you are women. And Swami would say that that's because all of you are Prakriti. And Swami is telling, you know, in his characteristic style, Swami is saying, just because you're wearing pant and shirt, don't think that you're a boy. You're also a girl. And then Swami is saying that, you know, sometime back there was this drama by the Anandapur students. You know, you would have this, I think, Kingdom of Sai would stage a drama during the Christmas time. So Swami is saying that they all put up a drama. They're all girls. But one acted as a king, one acted as a soldier, then there was a minister. But they're all girls. So Swami is saying, you're all like that. You're all wearing, you know, some of you are wearing pant and shirt, some of you are wearing a dhoti, but all of you are girls. And then Swami went on to say this beautiful description of Ardhanarishvara, you know. And Swami was saying that what is the significance of that Ardhanarishvara? Swami was saying that God is like that. God is both Prakriti and Purusha together. Right? And Swami was saying that, but you don't realize that you're also Ardhanarishvara. He says your body is Prakriti, but your soul is God.
Your Atma.
Your Atma, that is Purusha. And Swami is saying that when you realize that, and then you will not worry about the body, which is the Prakriti. The nature of this body is to change. And that change also might be birth and death. Right? It's not just aging alone is not that change, but even wearing this body today and wearing another body tomorrow, what you refer to as death is also part of that game. And when you know that, Swami said, you will be focused on the Purusha, which is the only reality. So when you look at that as our journey, when you look at that from Swami's point of view, I mean, one who is absolutely always established in that reality, for him death and the body, assuming a body or taking a body, I mean, that does not mean anything at all. Only if there is a purpose for that body to be held on, he will hold on to it. And only if that there is a larger purpose in letting go of that body is there, he lets go of that too.
Very well put. In this case, there was a purpose in getting back the body, and that is the reason Krishna fetches the son and offers him to Sandipani, and Sandipani is again in tears. And this is one of my favorite dialogues that I would like to quote, that this is what God does. Before God comes into your life, you are shedding tears. After God comes into your life, you are shedding more tears. The only difference being, the first case is hot tears of sorrow and pain and separation. Next is the cooling tears, blissful tears, sweet tears of joy. Lord converts our tears of sorrow into tears of joy. And that is what Krishna does for Sandipani. So Sandipani is very, very thrilled to have got his son back. After this, the chariots arrive and it is time for Krishna and Balarama to leave. And there is definitely the pangs in Sandipani that he will be missing Krishna and Balarama. Who will not miss them? And having completed their education, in fact, putting in true words, actually having completed education for everyone else, having shown a student how a student should behave, having shown the teacher his reality, having conferred on Sandipani the fruit that he had been longing for, having done all this, Krishna and Balarama return back. But as I said, in between there are one or two episodes that happen, especially with respect to Sudama and Krishna. Possibly we'll take that up in the next satsang, because the story of Sudama and Krishna is elaborate. And please correct me if I am wrong, Prem. Have we covered the story of Sudama and Krishna?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we've spoken about that. Yeah.
So I think in that context, it will be better that we keep aside this childhood episode of Sudama also, because they are connected. It's a beautiful story. I'm sure many will know it. And Swami has not gone into great detail in the Bhagavata Vahini, but it's part of the Bhagavatam. It would be wonderful to hear that, because that also forms, that also has its roots and connections in this life at the Sandipani Ashram.
And this whole episode ends so beautifully, where, you know, when Krishna is parting, Swami writes that Krishna goes to prostrate before the Guru. Krishna is playing his role of a disciple, and Swami says that even Sandipani is playing the role of a guru, because he says that even as he is allowing Krishna to fall at his feet, mentally he is offering his prostrations to Krishna, saying that, you know, you are my guru, I am not your guru, but the roles that we are playing does not permit us to do this. Permit me to come and fall at your feet. So Swami says that he offers his prostrations mentally to Krishna, and even as he allows Krishna to, you know, leave his presence and go back to Gokula.
With that, dear listeners, we come to a logical conclusion for today's satsang. We hope that you have enjoyed this description of Krishna as a child as much as we have enjoyed, if not as much as Parikshit enjoyed. We will conclude this, as we said, and continue with the episode of Sudama in the next week's satsang, because next week is also the Bhagavata Vahini satsang. In the meanwhile, as always, you can write to us at listener@radiosai.org with any of your feedback, your comments, your thoughts, anything related to this theme or any other theme as well. Whatever is relevant to this theme, we will make it a point to try to share it in the next satsang. Thanking you for your patient listening. Thanking you for this wonderful satsang, this global satsang that Bhagwan has made possible for all of us. We ultimately offer our gratitude at Bhagwan's lotus feet. We will end now with a bhajan, on the other side of which, as always, you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
single story of His infinite glory, captured through divine discourses, music, bhajans, and through Vedas, talk shows, interviews, panel discussion, and study circles. All brought to you live from the epicenter of our times, Prashanthi Nilayam, India. Radio Sai Thursday Live.